Court of State of Nevada is now in session. The Honorable Chief Justice Hardesty presiding.
Good morning. Please be seated. The first case on the court's en banc oral argument for Tuesday, November 3rd, is James Walker versus the State of Nevada, case number 49507. Ms. Thomas, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, I am. Thank you.
All right, you may proceed.
Good morning, Chief Justice Hardesty, members of the court. I'm Jonelle Thomas. I'm pleased to appear today along with Elzora Jackson on behalf of the appellant, James Walker. This appeal presents a number of issues. I would like to discuss the jury selection issues, the juror note issue, and the voluntary intoxication instruction. Ms. Jackson would then like to discuss the severance issue, and we're hoping to reserve 10 minutes for our rebuttal argument. The first issue which I would like to address concerns the Batson challenge and the race-based questioning of a juror, Mr. Henderson. The first veneer panel that was called in this case had only one African American on it. That was Mr. Henderson. He was treated differently than the other jurors who had been examined that morning. The disparity began as, unlike every other juror, where the prosecutor did the first examination and then the two defense attorneys or two groups of defense attorneys went second. The prosecutor deferred to defense counsel first and then asked questions that were far different from the other examinations that had been given that day. He began with, "I'm going to ask you something in the end and hopefully you won't take this wrong." And then went on, "So far in this jury panel, you've been the first African American we've been able to talk to, and my concern is in the event that you're chosen as a juror," and this continued, "do you find that because you're an African American male that you may have some ridicule coming to you from your associates, other African Americans, if you vote to put another African American on death row?" That question was not acceptable in 2007. It was not okay to single out the only African American juror or potential juror in that room and ask him questions that were based upon racial stereotypes and racial assumptions. That question is never asked in a case with white jurors and a white defendant. White jurors here were not asked if they would face pressure from their friends and family if they gave a death sentence. And by singling out this one individual, and then upon objection, the district court not sustaining the objection, not stating that that was improper, but instead joining in and going along that same line of questions, this entire proceeding became tainted. Not just because Mr. Walker is an African American, and because his counsel is an African American, and creating a racial tension within that courtroom, but also Mr. Henderson deserved to be treated with greater dignity, and the entire jury pool, because there was no individually sequestered voir dire, as had been requested by defense counsel, was tainted. Defense counsel requested a mistrial. Under these circumstances, that mistrial should have been granted. The state went on to exercise a peremptory challenge against Mr. Henderson, and a Batson challenge was made. The state gave some explanations as to why he was singled out, but an examination of the record, an examination of the context, suggests that these were not the actual reason why he was dismissed. Submit that a prima facie showing that a peremptory challenge was based on race was made, that the state's race-neutral reasons don't stand up within the context of the entire examination. The next issue which I'd like to address concerns the cross-section of the community. And
let
that's
me ask
a
question about the statement made by counsel about to this African-American potential juror. I know in the early 70s, it was common in Clark County that the only African American in the courtroom was the defendant. I was there a number of times. Judge was Caucasian, the defense attorney, the prosecutor, etc. And actually, we were allowed at that time to ask questions about race. And what's actually wrong with this? If I know that Charles Gary wrote a book about voir direing in the Black Panther trials in Oakland, and it was very important that he was able to ask questions about race.
And so, it is okay to ask about race. And a race-neutral question was asked, or a question concerning race was asked in the jury questionnaire. And it was asked of every juror. They said, this case involves an African-American defendant with a white victim. Is that going to be a problem?
Well, could you ask that to white jurors, potential white jurors, saying, jurors, look, you've got to go back to Spanish Oaks, or you've got to go back to Spanish Trails, this gated community where there's no African-Americans living, and how are you going to explain that this young black man is, you found this young black man not guilty of homicide of a white victim?
Certainly, questions of that nature could have been asked, but they were not. Instead, you've got the only African-American being singled out, being asked questions that were not asked of anyone else. The state claims in their answering brief, well, race questions were asked of a few other jurors. They were based upon jurors who responded to the question in the questionnaire. There was a juror who said, yes, I would have a problem because of race, and it was fair to ask follow-up questions based upon that question. Absolutely, I'm not saying that race questions are off limits by any means. They're important. But they need to be fairly made, and they need to not single out the only African-American potential juror in the room. And they need to not, and this man, the assumption that his associates, other African-Americans, are all opposed to the death penalty, that they're going to subject him to ridicule. There's no foundation for those questions. It's based upon stereotype and assumption without looking at the individual characteristics of this potential juror. As to the cross-section of the community, in this case of 120 potential jurors, only four were African-American, or 3.3% of the pool. Mr. Walker's counsel objected, asked that a new veneer be impaneled. At the last Clark County census, the percentage of African-Americans in the community is 9.1%. This means there was an absolute disparity in this case of 5.8% and a comparative disparity of 63.7%. This court has held if there's a disparity over 50%, that's an indication that the representation is not fair and reasonable. So then the third question is there a systemic problem? And it's where this prong is where the problem in this case exists. Here the district court summarily said, well, sometimes we have more, sometimes we have less. It's not a problem. That was not a sufficient inquiry. There should have been a hearing held. There should have been an examination. There should have been a full inquiry as to how is it working, because we know at this point that there are problems. This court's committee in 2002 on the Jury Improvement Committee noted that there were problems. There had been articles in the Las Vegas Sun, in the Williams case, the disparity had been argued about. And it was only after this trial in 2007 that the legislature amended the Utility Commission statute to provide that juror lists from utilities need to now be provided, that the DMV was not a sufficient representation. And so at the least, I would say this needs to be remanded for a new evidentiary hearing on the issue of how was jury selection in Clark County working at this point. But I think given the Williams case, given the historical records, the things that led to that 2007 legislative change, we can say there was a known problem, existed for a number of years. By taking no action to correct that problem, that is a systemic problem, and Mr. Walker should have received a more representative panel. The next issue I'd like to address concerns the improper questions from jurors. It is not our contention that jurors should not be allowed to ask questions. I'm not challenging the Flores decision in any way. What I am saying is the seven procedures that were outlined in that case were not followed in this case in very large part. The biggest problem, and this is a case where there are 104 jury notes, which is an incredible number of jury notes. Many of them have subparts. Some of them have four or five questions within a note. And where this case differed from Flores is these were not clarifying questions asked at the end of an examination of a witness. Jurors were interrupting the examinations on direct and on cross to ask questions as soon as they came up. Essentially, as soon as counsel would look down to look at their notes, there would be another jury question. The district court often did not consult with counsel about these notes and would ask them with no input from the attorneys whatsoever. There was no chance for objection to these notes.
And in what do you mean there was no chance for objection to these notes? I'm surprised by that. A lawyer can't point out, judge, you're not following Flores. Judge, you're not giving us an opportunity to review these questions, especially with this volume of questions. Why didn't defense counsel say, judge, the procedure that is outlined in Flores isn't being followed here? That never happened, did it?
No, it didn't.
What about the prosecutor? Did the prosecutor say anything either?
No one said anything about it. And part of that may have been a risk.
In what respect did the district court prevent the defense counsel from opening their mouth and saying, judge, this procedure exists and is not being followed?
I imagine that part of the hesitancy, having not been there, was not wanting to offend the jurors, not wanting to say, we don't want you asking questions, we don't wait.
Why couldn't this be taken up outside the presence of the jury?
That would have been a better procedure.
Ms. Thomas, I'm just, having done 100 trials with jury questions, I've never seen anything like this. This is such an easy procedure to manage and get done. I don't know why either attorney wouldn't have just said, Your Honor, can I approach the bench and say, look, I want to make an objection to the question so the jurors don't hear it, and you have a right to object, but either side does, and do it outside the presence of the jury or at a sidebar outside the courtroom. But I was just dumbfounded reading these materials about why neither attorney approached the judge and raise the issues that the Chief Justice just said, you know, what these are the procedures, why we want to object, you know, let us do it under Flores.
And I certainly wish that would have happened. I wish the district court judge would have followed Flores. But the fact is that Mr. Walker became a part of a situation where jurors did not sit back as neutral arbiters, where they were actively prosecuting the case. 104 juror notes is an incredible number.
Ms. Thomas, in one case, though, wasn't there an objection as to the question, and the court then gave a corrected question?
There were a few instances where there were objections.
And likewise, weren't the attorneys allowed to ask follow-up questions to the questions presented by the jury?
There were. There were some times when that happened, but there were many, many times when the district court, mid-examination of a witness, would stop, let the jurors ask some questions, and then return to counsel. That was not...
But you had stated that they weren't given an opportunity to object, and clearly the record would indicate that if counsel was able to interject that the question was factually invalid, and then the court restated it for counsel, they did have an opportunity to object.
And I think there were a variety of situations presented. There were some questions where the district court did hesitate to ask. Some flags went up, and the counsel was given that opportunity. But there were many, many more instances where counsel's input was not sought at all. And I imagine counsel, not wanting to offend the jurors, didn't interrupt and didn't say, would like to be heard on this. And I agree the better procedure would have been for that to happen. But the fact is, the jurors here took on a new role that went beyond that which was allowed in Flores. And I think it was
assuming for the moment that the jurors were overzealous in their role in asking questions, the absence of any objection makes review of this matter a bit awkward by this court. Can you give me an example of a question which was prejudicial, amounting to plain error?
Certainly, Your Honor. I set it forth in a footnote during the penalty phase as victim impact evidence, and it's in footnote 7 on page 40. Victim impact evidence was presented by the victim of another offense, not this offense, and that was in direct response to a jury inquiry where the district court allowed the question without consulting counsel. That question was in violation of Sherman versus State. And I think it's important, though, to also consider the cumulative impact. This isn't like Knipes, I believe that's how you say it, with four questions where counsel didn't have the opportunity to object. There were a considerable number of questions. Finally, if I may, the voluntary intoxication instruction. Defense counsel requested this instruction. It was denied by the district court. Submit that under Garner, Andre, and Vincent, Mr. Walker was entitled to this instruction. There was some evidence presented by Ms. Simon and Mr. Cole that would have supported finding that the perpetrator was either on drugs or intoxicated. And I think just the common sense looking at how all of this went down would also support such an inference.
Isn't there a little bit more, though? I mean, there was some testimony as to the his general demeanor. But if I remember correctly, there was no testimony as to what allegedly had been ingested or how much or when.
That's correct. There was not. But I'd ask you to contrast this to the flight instruction that is routinely given to the state, where just any small amount of evidence showing flight results in that flight instruction. I submit under the facts of this case, with testimony of the two of the direct victims, the intoxicating effect, maybe the jury would have discounted it. Certainly the state could have argued against it, but it was a factor that should have been allowed to be considered by that jury.
In this case, the court seemed to hold that because the jury was aware that there might be, but the fact that there was no testimony obtained to show that what the defendant had consumed, the effect, the substance, and how it might have affected his mental state, they weren't going to allow it.
Your Honor, I submit that's an issue that's an ongoing issue. That evidence was within the ability and control of the state. The state arrested Mr. Walker shortly after this offense. These offenses took place. He was in Mr. Walker in the state's custody. The state could have had a blood test done on him.
But Mr. Walker is the one who's asserting this fact.
That's correct. But
Mr. Walker shouldn't have to testify. Mr. Walker's asking for this instruction.
That's correct. But I don't think he has to testify in order to get this instruction. I think it, you know, like the flight instruction, it's something that ought to be on the table, something that the jury ought to be able to consider.
Isn't there some minor sufficiency that would be required, though, to get that instruction?
There is the standard in Garner, and I submit that standard's too high, that to show the intoxicating effects. It's an imbibing effect. The state has the burden here of showing that the perpetrator in this case acted with premeditation and deliberation. There is evidence in this record to say that the perpetrator was intoxicated or under the influence of drugs. The jury ought to be able to consider that as a factor. It doesn't mean it's dispositive, but they ought to be told that that's a valid consideration for them. If I may, I'd like to turn the podium over to Ms. Jackson.
Before you do, you caught me off guard on footnote 7 because my copy of the brief didn't have a footnote 7.
Oh.
What page is footnote 7 on? I go from
40.
Footnote 6 to footnote 8.
I have a footnote 7 on page 40.
Okay, I got it. Thank you.
Okay.
Please, the Honorable Court, Chief Justice Hardesty, and members of the court. I would like to address the issue of severance with the court's permission. It is our contention that Mr. Walker's case should have been severed from that of his co-defendant, Murtis Archie. To not have severed these cases resulted in a violation of Mr. Walker's state and federal constitutional rights. Mr. Walker ultimately did not receive a fair trial as a result of the lack of severance, and therefore the jury's verdict in this case is unreliable and constitutionally infirm. I would direct the court to its most recent pronouncement in that regard, the Chartier case versus State. The authority granted by the statute in these cases is permissive authority to the trial court to sever defendants. When the trial court fails to do so, the defendant, the appellants, must show prejudice by the misjoinder, and on appeal, the appellant has the heavy burden of establishing that the judge's discretion was abused. The key legal standard set forth is that a misjoinder requires reversal only if it has a substantial and injurious effect on the verdict. And in this case, Your Honor, we believe that this certainly is the case. As set forth in, I think, both the appellant's brief and the state's brief, Mrs. Archie's theory of the case was that she was merely present. She was simply there. Most of the evidence that connected Ms. Archie to these offenses, the two offenses with which she was alleged to have been involved, consisted of her vehicle being cited, and at one in the murder count, one of the witnesses memorizing part of the license plate, and then through investigation and the DMV records, the vehicle being traced back to her. Ms. Archie essentially conceded her presence at these offenses at the scene. This defense resulted in tacitly and impliedly placing Mr. Walker there also. And her defense, her theory was that she was there, but it was my client, Mr. Walker, and Mr. Walker alone who perpetrated these offenses without cooperation or planning by Ms. Walker, by Ms. Archie, excuse me. And Mr. Walker's defense was one simply a mistaken identification. Now, Mr. Walker has a specific due process and constitutional right to have the state prove each and every allegation of every offense beyond a reasonable doubt. Ms. Archie did not testify. However, her defense attorneys did an effective job, a very effective job, of setting forth her theory of the case throughout these proceedings. For example, a situation very similar to what happened in the Chartier case. The facts giving rise to the murder count involved a young lady, Eloise Klein, describing having a conversation with Mr. Walker before the violence takes place. She described for the jury an argument. She described it as fussing, where the man was directing Ms. Archie to park here. And it was very clear from her testimony that Ms. Archie was appearing to resist these instructions, thereby giving rise to the assumption that Ms. Archie was somehow being coerced. There was further testimony after these events that the lady, Ms. Klein, the witness, she hears the man say to Ms. Archie, drive this mother effer, you mother effer, being very vulgar and very intimidating and very coercive, if you will, towards Ms. Archie. And what that served to do is to create a second prosecutor and a second theory diverse from the state's theory that there was a conspiracy and cooperation. You essentially have the defense attorney for Ms. Archie creating the aura in the courtroom that Ms. Archie is simply yet another victim of Mr. Walker. And it's impossible for that to be properly met by counsel. And it's not speculative, Your Honors, if you look at the verdict. The verdict on the murder count for Ms. Archie, the jury rendered a second-degree verdict, which, with all due respect, is nonsensical. You cannot get to a second-degree verdict for Ms. Archie on the facts of this case. It simply shows how effective defense counsel for Ms. Archie was in portraying her as a victim. And the state analogizes the situation to the line of cases of Marshall, where Mr. Marshall testified and sought to implicate the co-defendant. And this case is even worse because we don't have Ms. Archie testifying. So we have no way to meet that particular testimony.
Certainly, the facts in this case, as they relate to Mr. Walker, I would concede candidly, from a defense attorney's point of view, are difficult. However, we are not here to determine, did Mr. Walker do what he is accused of doing? The issue is, did Mr. Walker receive a constitutionally sound trial? Did he receive due process? And was the verdict in this case reliable under the standards set forth by this court? We would submit that it is not. This particular victimization, if you will, of Ms. Archie was evident also in the events giving rise to the attempt murder charge of Mr. Kurt Cole and Deborah Kendrick. This court may recall from the brief that Mr. Cole testified at trial that the lady, and again, Ms. Archie conceded that she was the lady, it was her vehicle, she was there, that the lady received $20 for giving the ride to the from the store to the house, and that the driver got back in the car. And even provided testimony, the victim of the attempt murder did, that the lady said, oh, heck no, not like this, further distancing herself from the man involved.
In any way did Archie's defense implicate Walker as the person who stabbed the parties?
Yes, Your Honor. And essentially because they were arrested together, and essentially because of the overwhelming evidence the jury heard that they were together, he was arrested at her home. There was ample testimony in the record to support that. When you have Ms. Archie conceding that, yes, I was there, and the man, and there would be body movement towards my client when this is said, the man, it was a tacit concession. And it was the most insidious type, Your Honor, because how can we address that? And of course, and I don't mean to be improper, I am usually in the trial forum. Part of what does not make it into this record is counsel's placement of himself as certain questions are answered and asked. But certainly there was a very subtle, clear indication that Ms. Archie conceded her presence and that the man was none other than Mr. Walker. That's it. That's all. It's a wrap. And how can we defend against that? And I would submit to the court that the most persuasive piece of evidence this honorable court has before it of that and how effective it was is the second degree verdict. There is no way legally and logically the jury could have reached a second degree verdict with regards to Ms. Archie, but for this tacit, insidious second prosecution of my client that occurred. One of the cases that is set forth in our brief and cited by my co-counsel, Ms. Thomas, is the case of U.S. versus Lewis, 787F2nd, 1318. The Ninth Circuit makes a comment in that case that I thought was very appropriate to these proceedings. The court commented that to ask the jury to ignore certain evidence, and in that Lewis case, the certain evidence they were referring to were prior bad acts, and determining whether or not the defendant committed the offense being tried for is, quote, to ask human beings to act with the measure of dispassion and exactitude well beyond mortal capacities. And essentially that goes towards a question asked by Justice Douglas. We give juries instructions, and juries are presumed certainly to follow the law. However, there are certain considerations that this court and other courts have recognized that would require almost superhuman effort, and oftentimes it's just impossible to do that. And I think that this is a situation based upon the standards set forth by this case, this court's own cases, to ask the juries to ignore this victimization in the second prosecution would be require superhuman efforts. I would like to just briefly touch on, I recognize the U.S. Supreme Court has said the fact that one defendant is subject to the ultimate punishment and another is not. It's not a sufficient basis for a severance. However, with all due respect, I would submit that it bears mentioning in this case where we have acknowledged as a civilized society, going back to the 70s and Gardner v. Florida, that death is different to have such different priorities in jury selection. I would note for the record that Mr. Walker had a very different objective and goal, and we had our peremptories with Mr. Orem, the other defense attorney, and I believe the record will support my statement that each and every juror that we were successful in challenging for cause, Mr. Orem would make a record and indicate that that would have been a perfectly suitable jury for him, which is, again, indicative of the cross purposes with which counsels were laboring under and how that ultimately infected the fairness of the proceedings. And lastly and quickly, Justices, if I may, we would contend also that the cases themselves, we have here three separate cases, they should have been severed, especially in light of the graphic nature of the events giving rise to the murder case. Ms. Christine Anziano was stabbed to death on tape. I think that Ms. Thomas mentions in her brief it was shown over and over and over again. We actually watched her die time and time and time again. That type of inflammatory, very disturbing evidence, and they could have, and then the victim of the, am I out of time, Chief Justice?
Yes, why don't you wrap up?
Thank you. Given the nature of the three separate cases, we would urge the court to consider the fact that they were tried together. We would quickly direct the court's attention to page 45 of our brief, where Ms. Thomas set forth three very succinct examples of how jurors perceive situations where you have one person who's accused of multiple offenses. I think it goes back to the standard set forth in Lewis. I thank you for your time and attention, esteemed court.
Okay. Mr. Owens.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. Justices of the court, Chris Owens on behalf of the state. Of course, we've talked a lot, and there's a lot of briefing about the grisly nature of the actions of the defendants in this case and their prior records, which were just horrendous. But I think there's a couple of things in favor of the jury's conscientiousness in this case that are important to note at the outset. One is the fact that they came back with a lesser murder count on the female defendant, who was essentially the getaway driver in the case. Notwithstanding the fact that they found that there was a felony murder that was going on there, they analyzed the facts very carefully and found some room to grant her a little bit of adjustment there for culpability on that crime. Even though she had objected to being dragged along in the case with the stabber of Ms. Anziano, in fact, the jury seemed to have taken their duty very seriously there. And the fact that in the penalty phase, they came back, I think it was 17 mitigators. They listened very carefully to the information on the mental state of the defendant, the psychologist that was called, all of the family members and friends that talked about his background growing up and his family situation. And it was in the weighing where they determined that the aggravators outweighed the mitigators that finally made the death penalty available to them. I think it's important to note the very conscientious manner that these procedural and factual aspects of the case suggest. Which brings to the first point, if I'll address these in the manner in which defense counsel raised them, unless the court wants to jump to another issue. But the race issue is an interesting thing in our courts, in trials over the last few decades as we've grappled with it. I know this court has looked at it through committees. Trial courts have looked at it. It's the large elephant in the living room in many of the cases that we have. And we've, based upon decisions from this court, from the U.S. Supreme Court, we've made a lot of adjustments to how we do business. But it's still not always something that we deal with comfortably in the proceedings. But here, I remember sitting there when counsel raised this question to the African-American juror, and I thought, wow, that's a very direct question to ask. But Mr. Kephart's an individual. It's very personable and able to cover a lot of these areas. And it was not offensive to the court or to the juror. And, in fact, it's not an inappropriate question when you think about it. I had a case a few years ago. I know one member of this court may remember the case of Anthony Dotson, where this exact problem arose in the jury room, had not been covered adequately, and we had a juror that refused to deliberate during the penalty phase based upon the exact tenor of the question that was asked by Mr. Kephart below. It was a question that had been asked of other jurors in the case, Caucasian jurors and many other jurors that were there on the panel, even before the time that Mr. Kephart had asked it, as well as in the juror questionnaire. And I don't think that it's accurate, as counsel suggests, that jurors who suggested a problem in the questionnaire were the only ones that were questioned on it during the voir dire examination. It had been asked a couple of times by Mr. Oram. It was asked by counsel for this defendant as well. The court challenged the juror on race issues, and there was even one juror that talked about the violence associated with race, and there was a considerable dialogue with her on the issue as well. And so the question was different in the juror that was asked only, but the question was a question that was throughout the proceedings, and rightfully so. But the juror was not excused on that basis. And the juror was questioned a lot, but all the jurors were. This was a voir dire that went out several days. And if you can select any one of the juror voir dire questioning processes, and it goes on for pages. This particular juror had a lot of things to talk about. He had a family, I think he said, of 14 people or so, siblings, and only three of them were not currently in prison at the time. He had a nephew that had been involved in a murder situation that had been upsetting to him. He had been murdered, actually, that it was gang-related. He talked about how gangs take care of their own. There was a lot of questioning about that. He thought that the system had maybe not been fair in the way that had approached it. And then finally, he said that he had a personal relationship with one of the defense attorneys for this defendant, Mr. Walker, that involved some sporting programs with their youth. And, of course, that was a concern to the state as well. The race-neutral reasons that he was excused were essentially these reasons that were expressed to the court. And the court found that there was no pattern of racial discrimination here. In fact, a record was made about other jurors that were placed on the jury, particularly at least one other African-American juror, other ones that were on the panel, and there did not seem to be anything inappropriate constitutionally with anything about the process with this particular juror and any of the other jurors here. Fair cross-section of the community requires a little more homework than defendants come to this court with here. We're talking about a process, and they just totally failed to be able to hit the thresholds that this court has discussed in prior proceedings with regard to how the panel was selected in this particular case. Juror questioning has been an interesting thing. At first, I found that I was kind of uncomfortable with that. The courts have adopted it. I have found it to be a very good thing, I think. I think the jurors frequently ask a very searching and meaningful question, sometimes things that the parties don't think to ask. It may be that the courts have gotten somewhat sloppy in the way that they manage this process down there. This came as a recommendation of a review committee from several years ago. And and based upon case law from this court, the courts have tried to implement this. But sometimes all you'll see in the record is they'll say counsel approach or we'll be at ease for a minute. And counsel, some judges take you out in the hallway and some of them take you up to the bench and you discuss it there. And the courts are not really good about documenting, well, we had two questions and here's what they were, and because you can't do it then, and sometimes they forget to do it later outside the jury's presence, and so sometimes we don't have a good record. But it's a little disingenuous, I think, to say with counsel of the caliber that we had here for the defendant that they just sat on their thumbs through this entire proceeding for weeks and let the court just run roughshod over them on these questions and never said, hey, judge, can we have some input on these? And they wouldn't have, because I don't think they were being run over on these questions. I think they had all the input that they cared to have. It may not be totally reflected in the record, but there's glimpses of it in there, certainly. And as the justice has pointed out a few moments ago, there's nothing to be pointed into in the record specifically where there was a violation of this process that was to the prejudice or detriment of the defendant, at least not in a sense that would cause error in the case. Severance of the defendants. There were at least a couple of motions, I think, pre-trial that dealt with this issue. The Charrier case came out sometime after this and looked at this issue again. The law didn't change, but the circumstances of this case are easily distinguishable from that particular case. The state was not dependent upon the statement of Ms. Archie, the co-defendant in this case, against this defendant, Walker. We didn't use anything of that nature. She did not testify, so there was nothing inculpatory that changed. There was nothing exculpatory that was not available to Mr. Walker as a consequence of being tried with Ms. Archie. He had all the exculpatory evidence that would have been available if the trials had been severed. Finally, this is not like the Chartier facts where you actually had one defendant doing the crime while the other defendant had hired him, where one defendant wasn't necessarily present at the time of the crime, so where the state was dependent upon a conspiracy theory of one to get the other. In fact, in this case, both defendants were present on the two incidents where they were both charged and were involved in one manner or another in the particular crime. This defendant, Mr. Walker, being the one most involved, being the one that was either stabbing Ms. Anziano or was slitting the throat of Mr. Cole. So to hear him object to being joined with Ms. Walker just seems to be very hollow in light of the actual facts and culpability of the parties in this particular case. There was no hindrance to Mr. Walker by the trial of these incidents together and by the two defendants together. When we talk about the severance of the incidents and the charges, we note in our brief that these all occurred within a 24-hour period. They were in the same area of town. Two were at the same location. One was across the street. They were both the shopping centers where the defendant would lurk and then walk up to people or engage them in conversation. And then when he selected his victim, then he would act. And in two of them, he stole purses. And in the other one, he stole a wallet and some groceries. They were all in the area of Pecos and Bonanza. He employed a knife in two of the instances. The same car was used on two of the occasions. And when the police, a short time after the completion of these crimes, found the two defendants together in Ms. Archie's residence, they found the fruits of the crimes or evidence of the crimes, or all three crimes were there. The police were all the same witnesses in three cases on this investigation, and the evidence all tied together. You had the Social Security guard card of Ms. Anziano. You had the blood of Mr. Cole on the bumper of the car, as well as on the shoes that were worn by Mr. Walker when he answered the door for the police search warrant. And finally, you had the keys that were in the purse belonging to Ms. Simon, the first victim, were sitting on a counter in that very apartment and were recovered through the searches of the police. The evidence would have been cross-admissible had these cases been tried separately. They gave a complete story, and it would have been difficult, if not impossible, for these witnesses to have talked about and told if this had been severed. All of these factual threads were interwoven in a fabric of guilt on all three crimes, and there was no prejudice to the defendant by the trial of all three of these charges. This was not a close case as far as where the state was dependent on one charge to implicate him on the other ones. And it involved the grabbing of purses on two of these particular occasions. And of course, the items from one of the persons that was found there in that particular apartment. So there was no error in the failure to sever the charges, and in trying the charges together would have been a total waste of time to have tried them separately. There was other interesting testimony in this case. They called a witness to talk about the process of appeals and actual process of executions. Mr. Pichetta testified during the penalty phase. It raised some things that distinguished it from some of the other cases that this court may have dealt with or that I've dealt with in the past. They did some of the other more regular types of things and a full opportunity to call numerous witnesses in mitigation in the case, and as I indicated in the penalty phase, the jury did find, I believe, 17 mitigators in favor of this particular defendant. We're very conscientious in the review, but it could not outbalance the net effect of the prior history of the defendant and the egregiousness of the crimes in this particular case. There was a 78 conviction where we had a Marine visiting Las Vegas with his girlfriend, fiance, and the defendant walked up to him and shot him in the abdomen area, and then he lived. About 10 years later, we had a battery by the defendant on one of the prison guards. It was one of several, but involved a more serious type of a battery that occurred. Then we had the cutting the throat and stabbing the spleen of Mr. Cole in this particular case and the robbery there. He's a very violent individual, and the evidence indicated an individual that throughout, even during the trial, refused to take any responsibility for his actions, but chose to blame all the way through the process his actions on other people. And even during his cross-examination of witnesses in the trial, tried to lay blame and tried to go after the character of the victims, and of the witnesses in this case that the state felt it needed to respond to with appropriate rebuttal. And in the balance, the jury found Mr. Walker wanting. I don't think it was a close case as far as the sufficiency of the evidence and proportionality to support their verdict in death in this particular case. And unless there's any additional questions.
What about the voluntary intoxication, Mr. Owens?
Okay, I'm sorry. I forgot about that one. You know, the court case law in that area has not suggested yet that you get it just for the asking for it. The evidence was very thin. One witness said she thought he might have had bloodshot eyes. Another witness said he was talking very quickly, so he thought he might have been drinking, but there was never any indication that they thought he was on drugs, specifically, or alcohol. There was nothing more specific than that. An important thing to remember here is that this was not a case of, yeah, I did it, but I was inebriated and my mental state was messed up. And I wasn't there. It was an identity defense that was put on. Now, I don't know if you can't have something, you know, totally, you know, inconsistent with that, but certainly there was not any sort of a reasonable threshold here that would have suggested that the jury should have gotten an instruction that would have been so contrary to all the other evidence in the case, and really, even on its own, didn't rise to the threshold necessary to even make it an issue in the case. I mean, there was just nothing there on that.
And just to go back to the question to the African-American juror, the state really has no objection to asking questions about race. Is that correct?
No. I really think it's compelled. I think it's a good idea. It's common sense. We just need to be very careful in how it's employed. Sometimes when we see this, we think, wow, you know, I'm uncomfortable with that. I don't know why. But then the more we think about it, we think, well, we need to get less uncomfortable with these issues, and we need to address them directly and make sure, not only on race, but in a lot of other areas, that we're getting the fairest jurors that we can. And we've all had experiences where we have been fooled, unfortunately, and after a lot of time and expense, we've heard from jurors after trials that people have had hidden biases in a lot of different areas that we're unable to root out, and it behooves us all to be very vigilant of our process in these areas to do the best we can in a process. It's not perfect, but we need to do the best we can.
So, Mr. Owens, with the change in how the jury veneers are summoned now using power bills and things like that, have you found that you get more minority veneer men and women, African-Americans, Hispanics, and all like that as with these recent changes?
I do notice that. But it's like, you know, the law of averages. In some panels, you may have an over abundance compared to the, you know, proportionality in the community that we're all aware of. In other words, you'll have less on any given day. It can be differences. The court, I think, has also taken steps to try to go out and determine why people aren't showing up as well, because there's some issues involved there that they need to be very active in trying to police and make sure that people are coming. So I think it has been very helpful. Thank you.
Any questions from justices for Mr. Owens? Okay, thank you, Mr. Owens. Ms. Thomas, your colleague used up your time, but I'll give you 3 minutes to offer any final comments in this case.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll go very quickly here. I'd first like to address the issue, which I did not discuss, with, concerning Attorney Ken Ward, who was called as a witness by the defense. He was not called to discuss the appellate process. Counsel objected to questions about the appellate process. He was called as a witness because the state put on evidence that Mr. Walker was convicted of battery, but did not tell the jury, neglected to tell the jury, that that judgment had been vacated on appeal. Mr. Ward was called to say that was an invalid judgment, and he subsequently entered a guilty plea to a lesser offense. That was the reason Mr. Ward was called, also to discuss some of the facts of that case that he had learned during his representation. It was the state who put on repeatedly, through Mr. Pichetta and through Mr. Ward, extensive evidence of the appellate process, which all violated Caldwell versus Mississippi. We are in no way contending that race-based questions should not be asked. Questions concerning race, particularly in a case of this type, are important. But what Mr. Owen says is they should be done carefully, and I agree, and that was not done here. They singled out an African-American juror, the only one on that panel, treated him differently, asked questions only of him, and the assumption that he was going to fool the system because of his feelings based upon the association, as though there's some convention of African-Americans where they are all called in to ridicule each other over death decisions, is ludicrous. Let's ask race-based questions when it's called for, but it needs to be done fairly and across the board and in a sensible way, and that was not done here. On the juror notes, this is a death case. Rule 250 applies. Proceedings are to be recorded. And the suggestion that things are happening out in the hallway, things are happening at the bench, the record doesn't support that here on this issue. But in any event, it shouldn't be happening. All of those proceedings should be recorded in a death penalty case. And finally, as to the victimization of Christina Anziano, this is another issue which we raised in the brief, where the prosecutors were very disparaging to defense counsel, because what they did was during the examination, the coroner said there were 28 injuries to her body, only 11 of them were associated with this offense. Counsel absolutely needed to ask those questions. Those autopsy photos were going to go back with those jurors into deliberations. They were going to see the 28 injuries. This case was bad enough already without adding extra injuries. And what kind of IAC claim would this court be seeing 3 years from now had they not challenged that evidence? Had they not said not all of these injuries were caused by this event? That's all they were doing, was explaining the evidence in an already bad case. It was by no means meant to disparage this woman or to victimize her again, and it was not a legitimate tactic for the state to make that comment. Thank you.
All right, Ms. Thomas, Ms. Jackson, Mr. Owens, we thank you for your briefs and your arguments here this morning, and the case will stand submitted.